Hi, how are you? It's the Greg Kelly Podcast. I'm back. Sorry for the delay. Have you heard about the break in the case? They arrested somebody in the Gilgo Beach serial killer, the Long Island serial killer matter. Rex Hoyerman, accused of murdering at least, I think, the four women so far, but they expect that list to grow. These women, sex workers, prostitutes, were discovered over, I think, a four-year period. Actually, no, I'm sorry. They were killed over a three-year period, September 2007 through 2010. And look, it's a big, famous national case. The victims were found 13 years ago. Now, it looks to me like the police department in Suffolk County, the regime right now, under the police commissioner there, who's been in power, I think, since early 2022, they have been totally on top of this, and they are the ones who solved it, and they decided to solve it. They formed a special task force in early, I think, February of 2022, and the district attorney out there, a guy named Tierney, also came into his position, I think, in January of 22 or December of 21. And their first initiative really was to form a new task force to bring this matter to a close, to find the guy responsible. And they did it in very, very short order. Now, that's a year and a half ago. They found Rex Hoyerman very, very quickly, however. And look, I want to play this. What am I getting at here? These guys did a great job. However, the case should have been solved 10 years ago, in my opinion. I mean, based on what they say in this press conference, this data, this information should have been obvious to the investigators, in 2010, almost immediately after these bodies were discovered, they had the information. And what did they do with it? What happened? How did this thing break down? There have been allegations of misconduct or just mishandling of this for a long time. There was a very controversial police commissioner by the name of Burke. He actually went to jail. He was running the investigation for a while. Look, it's all a mess. Thank God they got the guy, Hoyerman again. I say Hoyerman. That's what it looks like. That's how it's spelled. A lot of people are saying Herman. It looks like Hoyerman to me. But anyway, I want to go to Friday. This is Friday the 13th. Was it the 13th? Friday the 14th. Friday the 14th. This is the district attorney talking about just how quickly things turned and dramatically.
We made the commitment. We were going to take our talented, almost talented investigators. So in the district attorney's office, we took ADAs, myself included. We took analysts. We took detective investigators. And they worked on a daily basis with other talented investigators from all of the agencies here. We started that in February 1st in 2022. 6 weeks later, on March 14th, 2022, the name Rex Hoyerman was first mentioned as a suspect in the Gilgo case. A New York State investigator was able to identify him in a database, and from that point on, we used the power of the grand jury, over 300 subpoenas and search warrants, looking into this individual's background to bring us to this day.
Now, he talks about the cell phones next, and how quickly, again, they were able to determine where the killer was making the phone calls from. And it turns out they actually determined that he was making the phone calls from two places, Massapequa Park and Midtown Manhattan. Rex Hoyerman lives in Massapequa Park, was working in Midtown Manhattan. And they knew this 13 years ago.
One thing that became immediately apparent was at the time of each of the murders, the murderer, the defendant, Hoyerman, he got a cell phone and a burner phone, which is prepaid and anonymous. And for each of the murders, he got an individual burner phone, and he used that to communicate with the victims. Then shortly after the death of the victims, he then would get rid of the burner phone. And right away in December of 2012, FBI CAST analysts, special agents with the CAST unit of the FBI, they immediately began looking at that cell site data. They compared the victim's phones with the burner phones, and they immediately honed in on some similarities, specifically in the Massapequa Park area. And they looked at an area of a confluence of four cell towers, and they realized that this had significance because the perpetrator of these crimes was probably located within this area at or around the times of the murderer. And that was mapped out. That was called the box, and it was an area in Massapequa Park. The FBI also managed to do that for an area in Midtown Manhattan.
Okay, so what, right? They got this box, Massapequa Park. Massapequa Park is not a big place. I'm going to guess it's a lot smaller than Massapequa. I'm going to guess there are 20,000 people who live there. Let's just take a look. It's small, and this guy should have stood out based on, well, what you're about to hear.
We formed the task force. We began working collectively. And then a mere 6 weeks later, on March 14th, 2022, Rex Heuermann was identified for the first time. And the manner in which that was done was the New York State investigator looked at a database. Amber Costello, the day before her disappearance on September 1st, 2010, she met with an individual for the purposes of having him pay her money for her services. But she involved herself in a ruse where once the individual gave her money, and other individuals came into the house, pretended to be a significant others, confronted the individual with the purpose of making that individual uncomfortable, having him leave without retrieving his money. And that's exactly what happened. So that individual was identified as a person who was between 6'4 and 6'6, a large man, thickly built, not necessarily overly muscular, but just a naturally big person with glasses, white, and dark hair. Also of significance was that the fact that he was driving a dark-colored black first-generation Chevrolet Avalanche with a very unique feature that was between it's a pickup truck, so it was between the cab and the bed, and that was identified. Again, that was back in 2010.
The witness that's a lot of stuff they knew. That's a lot of stuff. 6'4", white guy driving an Avalanche, heavy set. We already know that he's in Massapequa Park and works in Manhattan. All right. and the Avalanche, by the way, do you know what the Avalanche is? What he's talking about? I've never heard of an Avalanche. I've never seen one of these cars. I mean, you have, but you don't notice it. It's just an ordinary looking pickup. It's a pickup it's actually a little bit different looking. It's got a triangular window between the cab and the bed, the pickup part. It's, and that triangular window is kind of leaning. It's like angled. It's a unique feature. And maybe the witness, who we believe might have been David Schaller, we're not sure. He's been in a bunch of documentaries. He was a roommate with Amber Costello. That's just a stunning amount of information they had back then. Now, were they sharing it? We don't know. What were they doing with this information? Was it getting to the right people? And Heuermann had an Avalanche. He had one back then, and they found one at his house last week. Listen to this.
But it wasn't until March of 2022 that database was searched by the task force, and this individual was identified. That individual was Rex Heuermann, the defendant. And right away, there were some commonalities that came right to the fore. Rex Yearman, 6'4", largely a large person, not necessarily muscular, but a very physically large person. He has glasses. He has that the dark hair. And also, of particular note, he owned, at the time, that first-generation Chevy Avalanche. But there was more. He lived at 105 First Avenue, which was located within that box area that the FBI first discovered in 2012. But there was more. Also, he worked at the time at an architect, he owned his own architectural firm, at an address at 19 West 36th Street in Midtown Manhattan. And that was also the area of interest that was identified by the FBI in 2012.
All right. Now, you could say, well, hindsight is 2020 and all that stuff. But I think there's gross incompetence going on here. There's a real problem. It's not like they had the suspect. He said the first time was in March of 22, Rex Hoyerman. That's the first time he heard his name. Now, maybe they meant it was a person of interest, not a suspect or something like that. It sounded to me like the very first time, but they knew they were looking, or they should have known. And I'm talking about the previous investigators, the investigators who were hot on the trail right after this thing happened, right after these bodies were discovered. In short order, they knew that the phone calls were coming from Massapequa Park and Midtown Manhattan. They knew it was a 6'4", burly guy who drove an Avalanche. Now, was he definitely the killer? No, but it was certainly somebody they should have sought out, right? How many 6'4", burly men who drive Avalanches and work in Manhattan and live in Massapequa Park are there? I think there's probably one. I think there's one. Maybe there are four. How many Chevy Avalanches are there in Massapequa Park? Or throw in West Babylon and all that. How many? How many could there be? I don't know. I'm not an expert, but I think they could have. Now, technology has increased a great deal, but are we relying too much on the technology? I don't know. I'm not a police officer. I'm just glad that the good cops took this thing over and brought it in for a landing. A person who's been involved in this since the very early stages is a very prominent attorney named John Ray. If you've seen any of the coverage about this over the years, you've seen him. He's been representing the families of some of the victims here, right? He's been their advocate. He's been their ally. He's been their friend. And he has been beside himself about how this investigation was handled up until the new regime took over in early last year. These guys are professionals. They're just so superior to what was happening when Burke was running the police department. But he knows so much about this case, and I just had a talk with him. We're going to talk. That conversation starts in a moment. But first, folks, I'm all fired up, and to keep myself going and get even more fired up, why not, huh? You live once. D'Espresso Libre coffee. I love it. Now, ever since the American Revolution, drinking coffee has actually been declared an act of patriotism, especially during times like these. We can't forget what makes us uniquely American. Hard work, self-determination, individual liberty. Freedom doesn't brew itself. And that's why I drink D'Espresso Libre. Founded by a Green Beret almost a decade ago, he developed a dedication to crafting outstanding brews after multiple overseas deployments. D'Espresso Libre coffee is 100% Arabica coffee sourced from the finest coffee farms from around the world. It is fresh roasted in-house once they receive your order. Let's see, D'Espresso Libre. The experience really starts from the moment you open the package. The aroma is so amazing. It's scrumptious. You want to eat this stuff. I'm not a coffee expert, but I can tell you that D'Espresso Libre coffee is out of this world, tasty, full-bodied, smooth. It gives me a delicious jumpstart to my day, rich in flavor and American values. D'Espresso Libre coffee encourages all of us to sit down together and unite with fellow patriots to celebrate our God-given rights. So, if you want to wake up every morning to a savory micro-roasted cup of coffee that supports quality coffee farmers, America's Special Operations Community. Yes, they do. They support the Special Forces and our great country. You got to visit DeEspressoLaBear.com. DeEspressoLaBear.com. Now, how do you spell that? D-E and then the word espresso. So it's D-E, espresso, E-S-P-R-E-S-S-O, LaBear, L-I-B-E-R.com. DeEspressoLaBear.com, L-I-B-E-R. Yeah, that's how you say it, LaBear. It's a veteran-owned, family-run, small business whose brew tastes as good as it will make you feel. And remember, freedom doesn't brew itself. So we thank DeEspresso LaBear. Please enjoy it like I do. And now my conversation with John Ray, amazing attorney who has not given up on these families and has been pursuing the truth all his life, really. And this is in the aftermath of the news that Rex Hoyerman has been arrested as the Gilgo Beach serial killer, alleged, but the evidence seems overwhelming. Just should have been, I think they should have connected the dots a lot earlier, our conversation. John Ray, thank you for joining me. John, who do you actually represent? You represent, the shorthand is, you represent the victims' families, but who specifically do you represent?
I represent two of the victims' families. One is the family of Shannon Gilbert, and the other one is the family of Jessica Taylor.
Are those individuals named in this in the information that was dropped by the district attorney?
Yes, district. Well, I should. That's a qualified. Yes, the district attorney and the task force have named Jessica Taylor as one of the victims for the good reason that she was clearly murdered. She was chopped up and found in two different locations. Shannon Gilbert, who was the lady who triggered the entire investigation when she disappeared and was found last amongst all those found, she is not considered by the district attorney's office, or I should rather say by the police department, to be a victim, because the police department concluded last year that Shannon died of an unfortunate accident. And that was the story, the spin they put out about Shannon since the time she disappeared on May 1st, 2010. And then they made it their conclusion last May.
So what was your reaction to the news on Friday, what you heard, and your overall reaction?
Well, I knew that the something was about to, an arrest was about to be made, or some other announcement was about to be made regarding DNA. I had had a very credible tip about it just the few days before it happened. So we expected it to happen. Excuse me. When it happened, I received a call at 6:20 in the morning on Friday morning of the arrest. And I wasn't surprised, therefore, but I was surprised at who it turned out to be, because that gentleman was not in our investigative files that I knew of. We had somebody named Rex at some point in our files years ago. We're looking now to see if we still have it. But, we didn't know this guy.
Was it the Rex? It was not the same Rex?
We don't know. I have a room in my office, a room that's just devoted to Gilbert's, filled with Gilbert boxes and with Gilgo Beach boxes. And so to go through it, it's the product of over 30,000 to 50,000 hours of work that we put in. So to go through it all and find it is just formidable. But we're going to give it a shot. However, I can say, honestly, nor my investigative team, we don't recognize this man.
So look, we're all happy that this was solved. This apparently has been solved. And it looks like the new team there, the regime, the district attorney and the police commissioner, Harrison of Suffolk County, they got into office just early last year, I think January of 2022. And by March, they had Rex Hoyerman's name and he was a suspect. And then they built this case. But this has been a long time. And how many years? 13 years. You've been frustrated. The families have been frustrated. Why do you think it took so long to solve this case?
Well, it's you should start with the point, I guess, that you made is a good one. Maybe that's where we start, and that is that District Attorney Ray Tierney and Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison, both who are newlings, just recently coming into office, made exactly the right choice in forming a task force of the FBI and other agencies to solve this thing. And it took them less than 2 months, and they already were on the way to solving the case from the 2 months from the date they formed the alliance of this task force. So starting from there, the wonderful thing about that is the great work that they did along with their respective departments. And great. But is it, the dark side of the coin or the flip side of the shadowy side of the coin is if they could do that in that short a time with the material they had, and that the key to that first level of discovery was the avalanche vehicle, they had that avalanche vehicle and they had the witnesses' names and the witnesses themselves who talked about Amber Costello and the avalanche vehicle for years. That's just a signal way of bringing to a head the constant question, why did it take over 12 years to do something that ended up being done in a number of weeks? And the answer isn't easy. We start with this, that right from the start, when the police first got involved, there was a primeval mental attitude existing that, when you're searching for people you consider, or searching for the killers of people you consider criminals themselves, and especially therefore sex workers, the attitude is more laid back and easy because they're not considered a great loss to society by, the institutional mentality. And so that plays a real factor. Of course, that disappears when the search becomes serious, and I don't think that the bias remained. But we also had this great factor that intervened, and that was that when they went searching for Shannon Gilbert and discovered all the other bodies first, the person who was in charge of the investigative team of police officers from the district attorney's office, from Thomas Spoda's office, was James Burke. James Burke was the de facto leader of the entire investigation of Gilgo and Shannon Gilbert.
He's the former police commissioner who had a lot of controversy, may have been involved in the death of a teenager when he was a teenager. That guy, correct?
That's the man. But as to that man, there's something far more important in relation to this investigation. And that is that this man had a predilection, which is a fancy word for an addiction, to having sex with sex workers. He even had a baby by one of them, and he solicited them wherever he could. And from what we can judge, there appears to have been a ring of workers coming out of his house at one point. So, and he was the police chief, and he was in charge of the investigation. Once Dormer, the police commissioner, had to resign under a cloud for having blown the Shannon Gilbert investigation by December of 2011, she having disappeared in May 1st, 2010. When Dormer resigned, and several days later, he resigned as commissioner, and Burke came in as the chief of police thereafter. Only a few days later, Burke emerges as the chief of police. So he was the de facto leader, and then he became the fact leader. He actually, in fact, was the leader of the investigation. And the very first thing he did was he shut down the investigation.
Do me a favor. I want to come back to him because that's going back a number of years. I want to go back to Friday for a moment, which also does go back a number of years. But the things that I heard in that press conference, and just like you said, I mean, it kind of makes sense that they solved it so quickly. The FBI, according to the district attorney, established a box of cell phone towers where they knew two boxes were established. One in Midtown Manhattan, where they knew there was the call activity, in and out activity with this burner phone, and another box, which he did say centered on Massapequa Park, right? So those two things were known all the way back in 2012. Also, what we seem to know is based on, and it didn't happen right away, it would have happened months later, because Amber Costello was found in like December of 2011. So they get around to interviewing her roommates, friends, that kind of thing. And they come up with David Schaller, who seems to have seen him and gives a description as an ogre, a big guy, huge, 6'5", maybe 40-ish. And he drives an Avalanche, which is a very distinct kind of car. Now I see him everywhere I go, Avalanches. But so conceivably, 10 years ago, not conceivably, likely, this is what they said. We knew that it was an Avalanche. We knew that Massapequa Park was a center of interest. We knew it was a big, burly, ogre-type guy, and that Midtown Manhattan had something to do with it. There are only, I think that should have taken those data points right there about 20 minutes to find Rex Hoierman, maybe a day. Do you see that? Am I just two Monday morning quarterbacking this thing?
Well, maybe it would have taken them a little more time than that, but certainly with the pinging towers, they were known. We knew them years ago. There was a tower that was in Massapequa. There was a tower that was in Freeport that was pinged. I think there might have been one in Long Beach.
Did you say, they said they used the word box. Did you ever hear the word box, that they had a box, the FBI established a box where the cell phone activity was taking place, and it was in Massapequa Park? He made it sound like there was a box around Massapequa Park. That's what he said on Friday. Did they ever use the term box?
We never heard that term. That's their own term, I guess, in secret that they used, but we knew of the pinging towers for years, and we also had discovered some of our own towers that we learned about, that controversial phones were pinging off of. But long and short is, myself and my investigators, we had concluded that the killer or killers had to be within close range of the bodies, because typically they have two problems. They have distance and they have time that they have to contend with to get rid of the body after they kill it. So the further they go and the longer they're on the road, the more likely they're going to have a problem. So they tend to leave the bodies relatively close by. There are exceptions to that, of course, but that's generally a practice. So, you could expect that they would be by the pinging towers. And so we thought that as well. And sure enough, the bodies are within, a very short range of the Massapequa Tower, which would put that person, whoever did the killing, in that neighborhood or somewhere nearby. Of course, that's a pretty big territory it covers.
It's a big territory, tower. But wait, what if the Avalanche, though? So I don't think they got the name, the car Avalanche, in 2011 from Dave Schaller. He described, according to the DA, well, I'm actually kind of inferring all of this, but that he described the triangular slanted window that is between the cab and the kind of the pickup area. That's very distinct. I mean, it's unusual to the Avalanche. So he must have described that feature, and their takeaway was, okay, it's an Avalanche. I'm still kind of totally shocked that Avalanche, big guy, Massapequa Park, Avalanches. How many Avalanches are there in Massapequa Park? I mean, the guy still has an Avalanche, had an Avalanche back then. It's a pretty unique car. All cars are kind of unique. I mean, how many could there have been in any given community? I would say 4. I mean, I don't know, but certainly not 400. Look down the street. You're never going to see one. You can go out for 4 hours, 8 hours, looking for an Avalanche. You may or may not see one. Doesn't that just totally blow you away?
It certainly is a huge factor in it being consistent with the other approach, the rest of the approach that the police department used to investigate the case. They certainly did not interview fundamental witnesses. They failed to get records. I understand that that the task force attempted in 2022 to get the records, the phone records of one of the victims, and the phone records have disappeared. But you wonder why weren't these phone records obtained in 2012, 2011? You know, they weren't. So there are many things. I mean, there's a litany of things that they didn't do that they willfully appeared to neglect back then, there's a lot of controversy about what they did and didn't do. That controversy didn't go away because they've now a new team has solved it. The controversy remains. And there needs to be an explanation. I don't know. There needs to be somebody needs to come forward and tell us the truth about what really happened. You know, I was telling you before, I mean, this guy Burke, when he was in charge and he controlled it, and he appointed the people who, many of who are still there, or some anyway, who are still there working on the case, and he was in charge of that. He created the atmosphere, the mental state that dealt with this. And think about it. That's like taking a bank robber and putting him in charge of investigating bank robbers. Yeah. I mean, that's basically what happened here.
I have questions about him. I want to come back to him in a moment. Can I do me a favor, though? Can we talk about the belt that was unveiled by, I guess her name is Geraldine Hart, the former police commissioner, a couple of years ago? She revealed at a press conference what they called a significant piece of evidence, a belt with the initials either WM or MW. Yeah, wait, no, HM or WH, however you look at it. And that was a big deal. Number one, did you consider that a big deal? Was that a big day?
Yeah, I went to I held my own press conference outside of the police press conference on that day. So, yeah, it was a big day because it was the first time the police were going to give any indication of evidence. We thought, we didn't know, you know, when they called it, they surprised everybody. We thought that they were going to give us significant things, but instead it was pablum. I mean, to hand out a belt picture, it wasn't a belt, it was a picture of two initials up close on a belt. You didn't even get to see the belt. You don't know how wide it was. You don't know how long it was. You don't know its belt buckle size. You didn't see the belt buckle. You saw nothing except the initials. And in two photographs, that one was turned upside down of the other. So, it was not even tantalizing. It was useless.
It was confusing.
You know, that was because they were going to suddenly have more transparency, said that commissioner. And, of course, that didn't last long. But there was no transparency, as you can see. Now, maybe it's time to let the public, which is a very intelligent body with people with computers all over the world who are very good at doing the research and finding things and knowing things, and letting them know more of the evidence so that they can be helped.
Right. Crowdsourcing is actually, and you can't do it on everything, but that belt episode was very bizarre. Somebody asked at the end, someone asked, And the questions actually, I went back and watched, were actually decent. Well, what is the length of this belt? I.e., you know, it'll give us an idea of the size of the person. And they would not say that, which is, I mean, inexplicable why they would not. I mean, there's no reason whatsoever. Other than I think they're just unsophisticated in dealing with the press. Looking at it now, I do believe this. It's, and you're right, the picture was just the tab of the belt. But let's say it's HM, not WH, HM. Now they say, well, that's not Rex Hoyerman, but Hoyerman. Some people say Herman, Hoyerman. You can, Hoyerman actually means hire man in German. You hire a man. and maybe this was his own kind of way of his unique abbreviation for his name, HM. I mean, they're two distinct words in that surname. And if they had put it out a bit more responsibly, a bit more aggressively, the whole belt, and I think they probably should have said, okay, this is either HM or WH. When I saw the belt, I'm like, no, there's no way that it would be WH. It's HM. But that was very frustrating and weird. Would you agree? Yeah, I mean, you just said so. I just, what do you, can I ask you, what do you make of my analysis of the of HM?
Yeah, I had the same thoughts after I heard of this fellow, that they could very well be related to his name, those two initials. But, it almost doesn't matter because if you think about it, going back to Hart's revelation, what did that, knowing what we now know, how would that revelation have advanced anything? It wouldn't have advanced. They wouldn't even net match. Who would know that it was two letters from the same word? It's absurd, right? I mean, to expect somebody to figure that out. And so why did that get released in the first place? It was insulting, really, the press and the public.
Look, if they said we don't know these are initials or not, if they just put it out and they put out the entire belt, let's say it was a 44-inch belt. So it's a 44-inch man. Now we're looking for a 44-inch, you know, waist. And oh, by the way, it's centered in Massapequa Park. And oh, by the way, it's an avalanche. And oh, by the way, spends a lot of time on the Long Island Railroad. I mean, I know this stuff from watching the documentaries now. I can't believe that they weren't able to do this on their own. Can we go back to Jimmy Burke? So what do you think his motive was? I mean, did he think his name was going to be revealed? And is that one of the reasons why he wanted to keep this? He wanted to thwart the investigation. If he did, I don't know that. I mean, but it would seem to be, it's very plausible. But do you think he was worried about his own name being revealed as a user of prostitutes? Or is that like widely known? Did people understand that and like, oh yeah, that's just Jimmy Burke?
That he used sex workers and had an addiction to them was not widely known in the public at all. But it certainly had to have been known in the police circles of the higher ups. Why? Because he would bring these girls, two of them I know he brought. They talked to me about it. He brought them to police dinners and the like and struck them around. So, he even got caught with Loretta Rickenbacker having his gun twice and got busted in rank because of that. So it was well known in police circles that he was up to no good with that. And apparently he had other troubles in Brooklyn dealing with prostitution. So, personally, that is, the evidence we have about Burke's involvement is vast. When you take that into account and you've let that robber study the robbers, as it were, then what can you expect that the result is that the first thing he does is he shuts down the investigation on the absurd theory that cadaver dogs, cadaver sniffing dogs don't like to be out in the marsh in the winter. First of all, there was only one dog in the whole department that was doing the search. The rest of the dogs that you see in the films were fakers. They were dogs, but they weren't cadaver dogs.
Was that Blue? Blue was the dog? Was that the dog's name?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and so this thing gets shut down until March. giving him breathing time to do whatever had to be done. And then when it finally does get started up again, it never reaches the point that you can see the task forces in or at. No way. It just drags along in the traditional fashion. And then even the knocking on the doors and interviewing witnesses and so forth, the key people, was not done.
So wait a second, though. Okay,
I mean, something was done, but you could see that not enough was done.
Burke is a strange guy. What about the people who are working on the task force? I mean, there had to be some really good detectives out there. Were they being stymied? Were they being handcuffed? Were they being jerked around? What do you think was going on there?
Oh, we know. We don't just think. Even Commissioner Hart said, she actually said that this occurred, that Burke told the police department to stand down from cooperating with the FBI and other police agencies. So the Suffolk County Police and the FBI basically separated in the investigation, as well as the Jersey City Police Department, which was investigating Shannon's disappearance, the New York City Police Department, the Nassau County Police Department, where two of the bodies were found over on the Nassau County line. But Burke just took over the investigation completely, boxed everybody else out. You know, you can imagine all different reasons for it, but the fact is that it was done and the culture was established. So nothing happened at all to advance the cases until I brought in Dr. Michael Bodden at my request to come in and do an autopsy of Shannon Gilbert once I was able to acquire the bones from the medical examiner's office. And I was able to get Michael because not only did I know him from when he was working once in Suffolk County, he's the world-renowned.
It's a big deal. What did he find?
Yeah, and Michael, his brother Bobby and I, his brother Bobby worked with him on the autopsies. His brother Bobby and I played semi-pro football together many, many years ago.
Oh, my God.
So
what did he
we
find?
Had a good connection, and we brought him in. Once he did that, we discovered that in Shannon Gilbert's neck, the hyoid bone was fractured, which means she was strangled. There was also a hole drilled right through the middle of the bone or punched right through the middle of the bone. So we knew that she had been murdered, and we held a press conference to say so. And I got a call then from the police department, and they told me, oh, we'll cooperate with you now. We want to talk with you. They never called back. And from that day on, they never called back. So,
and Michael Bodden is a big, big deal. You just don't dismiss his findings. Let me ask you, though. All right.
So they didn't do their job.
Sure.
You could see that.
You mentioned earlier, look, possibly because they're sex workers, prostitutes, they're criminals themselves or they're involved in criminal activity. But there's this. Well, this would not satisfy why they're not pursuing the investigation. I guess initially, if they get a missing persons report on a prostitute, prostitutes come in and out of society. They kind of, they're not exactly 9-to-5 people. And there's that component to the lifestyle. They tend to just live erratic lives. I think that's safe to say. And that would kind of explain an initial reluctance to tie this all together. But once they knew they had a serial killer on their hand, you really think that because they were sex workers, there was still reluctance, delay, whatever. Because I just want to run this by you. I mean, some of the most famous serial killers in the history of the world preyed upon prostitutes. You know, Jack the Ripper. I mean, a serial killer is a serial killer, and they want their man. They want to find him. First of all, what do you think of my initial characterization? And was it still really a factor in slowing down this thing?
I personally don't believe so. I don't see any evidence that it was a factor in slowing it down. The status of a sex worker, I don't see it. I mean, the police investigate. They're fairly objective in that respect, in terms of status,
right?
You know, there may be exceptions, but
John, people were saying that. People were saying that publicly. I mean, that was being said, and I mean, all these documentaries, they all kind of felt that way, right? I mean, a lot of the people and the families, they really felt that way. It's not like, it's not out of left field. I'm saying this.
No, but there's I don't have any evidence that any of them expressed that, and maybe they held it in their hearts, but I never saw any evidence that the police department expressed that. You know, after the initial calls that were made that these girls were missing and the way it was handled, after you get past that, when the homicide folks came in, you didn't see or hear that. One thing, though, that was interesting is I never saw a female police homicide detective involved in this at all. That was kind of unusual, and I thought, I wondered why that was true. But you have to remember another thing as well. You know, parenthetically, you know, yeah, sex workers don't have a good reputation, and there's obvious reasons for that. But the modern time sex worker is usually a recruit. I speak from a lot of work in the courts on this, and in family court as well as in the other courts. So, you know, I don't know if this is common knowledge or not, but the prostitute, the modern sex worker, the young girl that comes into it is not this tough, gum chewing, smoking, you know, drinking, drugging person that they're portrayed as. They're usually most often recruited as young, lonely girls who are from small towns and have, you know, big dreams and have had maybe, you know, isolated or rough lives, but are usually, they're characterized as kind of sweet, and that they're typically also characterized as loyal. And those are the kind of girls that the people who recruit them are looking for. And they actually have a pretty sophisticated rings of sex workers today that are not like the old days where there was just a pimp and a streetwalker. That's just not true anymore with the internet. And so what are known as gorillas are these men who basically seduce the girls. And they do so because what are known as bottom girls find these kids and recruit them. And then the gorillas move in on them and seduce them by you know, putting them up in fancy hotels, putting them in cars, buying, you know, all kinds of clothing and baubles and the like, and making them feel really good about themselves, these lonely girls, and then, you know, demanding their loyalty in exchange, and then that they will someday bring them to Hollywood and make them famous, that sort of thing. And when they take these girls who have these naive dreams, and they're usually also very naive girls, they then train them, and then they start to abuse them slowly, and then they start to beat them. And what they do is they force them into submission, and they leave them with this kind of odd carrot and stick choice of, well, you know, you're going to get all these nice things, and you're going to get famous, and you're going to be great, and, you know, you're going to have money and so on. And if you leave, you're going to get smashed. So, you know, what which do you like? And that's how they do it, and to the point where they even enslave them and sell them as sex slaves. And, you know, that movie dramatized it recently, but it's actually true. So this is who these girls really are. They're really just the two girls I represent, their families I represent. They were really sweet, gentle girls. They were just the poor ladies. They just had they had these characteristics. So that's a very different, much more sympathetic picture of these girls.
Now, this outside of both of our areas of expertise, but you know, the term sex worker, some would say, is a bit euphemistic. And it kind of confers a certain legitimacy somehow. I did not believe that until, quite frankly, it's just somebody, a caller the other day on the radio said, yeah, I think that confers legitimacy. And I'm like, you know what? I think there's actually something to that. And why is that a problem? Well, because we don't treat it with the stigma that it deserves. What you just summarized is horrible, and it's true. And if we say sex worker, you know, maybe we should call it what it is. This is prostitution, and it's exploitive, and it's ugly, and it's dangerous. And I would not have had.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
It's all those things. It's exploitive and dangerous. Of course, it is. And the word prostitution is a legal term that exists in the law. and that it's made unlawful. But and so it's it you know the word itself has traditionally gained all of these you know negative lights. I think the choice of the phrase sex worker it doesn't glorify being in that field at all. But what it does is it attempts to show some respect for the victims, the girls' families, and their you know their real circumstances. So it neutralizes that, and it should, because precisely because of things where people like police departments look askance upon these girls and don't give them the treatment when they're hurt that others who are hurt should receive. So I have to say that I get the point, you know, about the word prostitute, but I also get the point about the use of sex worker, and that's why I try to use it.
I understand. John, is there anything I should be asking you that I'm not?
Oh, there's a ton of things.
I mean, look, we're up on, I could talk to you for, what are some other areas that we really should cover right now?
Well, you know, I think that you've touched on some of the main points that are in this case. We're, you know, our position now is, you know, get the task force should be enthusiastic, and I expect they will be, especially with all the public knowledge now of what happened, in chasing down the true killer or killers of these other girls. And they need to reopen the Shannon Gilbert case. So we're going to put a lot of pressure on them to do that. I'm happy to see that they're all working together. That works for me big time. I think maybe also you might want to talk about the circumstances of this man. You know, people talk about how he goes out and he kills these girls. I suggest, from my experience with these people, that he didn't start by killing a girl. He started, as you can see from his circumstances, he was a nerd in high school at Berner High School, and he started in watching porno. And if you don't think porno is dangerous, here's a good example of why it is. He started watching what was called soft porn porno. I have no doubt.
How do we know that?
Just because experience tells me that's how they start. Just like kids start with marijuana, they don't start with heroin. It's very much the same kind of thing. And they move from soft porn, and they like it, and they get excited by it, and they find it delightful, and they move secretly and happily to the next level, and the next level, and the next level. And each one pleases them and get, you know, brings the ecstasy to a point. And so they eventually get into the really dark web area, and they're looking at child pornography. And they're getting their kicks out of that. And then they move from that to even worse things, where there's torture and pain, and that's associated with sexual pleasure, and then eventually death. What happens is they then begin to go to the next level, which is to try it out themselves and really bring to a height what they have watched and watched. That's what I believe happened to this guy, which brings you into two areas of this activity. One is that people who are like him, involved in watching child porn and really get into it like he did, almost always have friends and connections with other people who do the same thing. They trade pictures with each other. They even talk about performance, relative performance of the children. And they even meet one another sometimes. So that would suggest that there's a strong chance that he has other people that are connected through the child porn aspect. And the same analysis applies to people involved in pain and you know, masochistic things of that, and sadistic things of that sort. They typically, you know, they exchange toys and sex toys and things of that nature. That belt, for example, is a very big belt. It was for a very big man, which he was. So it could be just a belt that went around his waist, but it could also be a belt that is used by these masochists and sadists. They typically buy these huge belts to tie people up, and they trade them. They talk about them. They even put their initials on them because they're proud of them. And so that would suggest that he might have a circle of friends in that regard as well. So one of the things that we'll be looking at, and hoping that I'm sure the police will be as well, are his circles of other interests and other friends. And that might take us to where you want to go with this, because we still think that this is bigger than just one man.
Okay. Now the thing about the, you still think it's bigger than one man. I mean, they kind of said the other day that this is the leading suspect in the other cases, but you really think that, well, he's been charged, I think, with four at this point, and you think, so he's not responsible for all 10. And I know
he might not be, he might be as well. We don't know yet. One thing that is consistent with him, which you need to know, is that he was a hunter, a licensed hunter. He took pride in his hunting, and he had lots of guns. He had 92 guns or something. And hunters, there's one thing about hunters: when they take their game, they know how to strip them down, cut them up, and they have the tools to do that. So the dismemberment, which is not an easy thing to do with a human body, could have been done by a trained hunter. So his avocation is consistent with that. So it's possible that he did the chopping up of these other people.
I did not hear that he was a hunter. Have you gotten any information on him that, you know, is not in the newspaper? Do you know what I mean? You've been so close to it. So are you getting information about it that we don't know?
As we speak, we have people furiously doing the investigating over the internet as we speak. And yes, we've gotten information that other people don't know, but I don't want to disclose it at this point. I think I prefer to work with the police or the task force in giving them what we have. That I think, since they haven't made anything public, I don't want to be inconsistent and step on their toes.
I understand.
Anyway.
Can
so
I ask you?
We'll handle.
All right, do me a favor. I want to get a little bit of your background, but before that, the idea of the like you just mentioned, you have like thousands upon thousands upon thousands of documents somewhere, right?
And, yes, we do.
The name Rex has come up, but you're not sure where.
That's true.
Now, and by the way, you're not a detective. I mean, you're not. My feeling tells me that they had a similar problem to what you have, or that they had all this stuff. But I actually asked a very senior, world-famous investigator about this, and he said, you'd be surprised. They literally don't have the real estate anymore, like the office space, to do what we see in television, where they put a big map up and everything like that, where they have one room dedicated to one case. After a point, we need the room back. We need the stuff. So it all goes into a box, or it's all in the computer. Technology has done some amazing things. We've seen amazing advances. But I feel like somehow we have taken a step back where the technology has taken off. We're not doing the kind of things that we did in the 70s and 80s and 90s, which is put the stuff up on the wall, you know, and keep it there. Or maybe they did and they had to take it all down. But I'm just still...
Well, the police department did have a war room for this case. I had people who worked with me who went in and saw it.
When's the last time you saw it?
I never saw it myself.
But when's the last time that we know it was like functioning? I mean, obviously it was functioning as of early last year, but before that, was there a war room?
Before that, yeah, it went all the way back to around 2014 that I know of. It may have gone, back to 2012, but I got that information around 2014. That existed.
Okay, so they were doing that.
Yeah, they were.
Where did you go to law school?
I went to St. John's University in Queens.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Hunter College, and I spent a year at the London School of Economics. I have a master's degree from Adelphi in history, and a lot of postgraduate work. But as a young man, I was kind of a typical kid out of control kind of thing. I wasn't really my saving grace was I always worked for a living, But and I played sports, so you know, I had to kind of work my way up through the system. But I became the commencement speaker for my graduating class at Hunter, and then I went on and I played semi-pro football, and I played lacrosse in high school, and I continued. My 57th year of playing as a goalie. I just missed my games tonight because I'm here talking to you. So I'm still in athletics. And I've been, you know, I've been a pretty well-known lawyer for many years now. I've had, since I started my practice, before I did my practice, I was a school teacher. And then I went to law school at St. John's and went on with my practice when I was 32 years old, 33. But when I did that, my very first case was a well-known public case at the time. I ended up shutting down a central school district, Longwood, because they used their budget to misadvertise to vote to pass the budget. And I rallied all the senior citizens in the community to oppose it. And we went to court and we shut down the school for doing that. And then right after that, a week later, I ended up representing a fellow named Noshiran Hatemi against the Mustazafan Foundation, which was the front organization for the Ayatollah Khomeini in America. And I sued them. I sued the Ayatollah. And that was right after I got out of law school. So I started off with a lot of well-known cases. And I ended up representing Dick Schaap's ex-wife in a landlord-tenant battle in New York City. So I had famous cases in my very first year or two of practice.
Dick Schaap, the sports guy?
Yeah, Dick Schaap was the sports announcer. And so I went on with many famous cases, and you know, I've really had a good career.
But if you meet somebody at a cocktail, like what kind of law do you, what's the shorthand for the law you do?
I do everything. I count myself as a specialist in whatever I do because that's the kind of time I put in. I work anywhere from 10 to 15 hours a day, every day. I very rarely stop. I work on weekends as well. And I've done that for 41 years. And so I've tried cases from, I've had over 33rd homicide case. And I've had all kinds of civil cases from personal injury to municipal law, civil rights.
Homicide cases in criminal defense.
In criminal defense work, yes, or representing victims, and you know I've done a huge amount of litigation, civil litigation of every kind of description. I do school cases, I do matrimonials, we do family court. I'm everywhere, and I've even tried tax cases, and I do that because I think if you learn the skill of the control of words. You know, what the fellow named, I think his name is Richard Weaver, who said that that ideas, words have meaning. And, words are the symbols of ideas. And so I live in the empire of words. If you can become in control of your words, both spoken, reading, and written, that's what you need to master in this business. And if you do, you can practice any law there is. And I've been up against firms that are humongous firms with several hundred lawyers against me in cases where I've held my own, not because I'm a hero or bright or anything of that sort, but because I worked on my case as hard as I could. And when you get into the courtroom, there's only two lawyers that are going to try the case, one on one side and one on the other. And when it gets to that, we're at, toe-to-toe and we're equals. So I could do any case.
I love it. I got to ask you about your clothes, which are very stylish and cool. Who's your tailor? Where do you get this stuff? And let's face it, you dress, you stand out. What brought you to that?
I've always dressed that way since I was a little boy. I always wore hats. And I've always dressed unusually. In high school, I did as well. Just a taste thing. And I've always had it, stayed with me. When I didn't have any money, of course, that wasn't easy to do. But, when I began to make a little money, and I don't profess to be a zillionaire by any means at all, but I befriended the clothiers at Paul Smith's, he's a British designer, Paul Smith's stores in New York, in the city, and you know, where I also have an office and an apartment. And eventually I got to be friendly with Sir Paul Smith. So I have many of my clothes come from his wardrobe, and he's a great designer. But I also have, you know, when I see something nice, I get it. And I, you know, and I wear a lot of hats.
Well, listen, fascinating talking to you. I really appreciate it. I'll ask you again. Is there, I mean, I got to respect your time, and I'm so sorry about the hockey game. Is there anything else you'd like to say or should say?
Lacrosse game.
No, okay.
Let me sum it up my clients in the victims' families that I have, as well as myself, we're just delighted with the work that the task force did, and with the leadership of District Attorney Ray Tierney and Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison. They really did something that nobody else was able to do, and that's to break through the bureaucracy and make it work. That's a pretty hard thing to do. So I praise them, we laud them, and we encourage them to continue. And I think with their leadership, they'll break through the silent blue wall that wasted a lot of time and will now hopefully emerge as the kind of police department it should be in Suffolk County, and we'll get this thing solved. And the only one thing that I'm, you know, really, I guess, devoted to is to make sure that they pay attention to not only Jessica Taylor, but also to Shannon Gilbert, and not kick Shannon Gilbert by the wayside as they had done.
Which started the whole thing. And if you feel comfortable, if you got five more minutes, I'm sorry, but sure. This whole thing with Brewer, he was the customer who called, summoned the sex worker, and Gilbert shows up, driven by Mike Pack. And take it from there. What really happened, in your opinion?
What really did happen is actually recorded. It's on a 23-minute tape that Shannon was made of Shannon's 911 call. And if you eliminate the police grossly misleading and willfully inaccurate story that they spun out for 12 years and made a video of last year, and you listen to the tape yourself, the entire 23 minutes, and you know the facts that we have, you would know without a shadow of a doubt that Shannon Gilbert was in a tough spot. She either had to stay in the house where she went with Brewer and worry that the people outside were going to kill her once she went outside, or remain in the house and have them come in and do so. She had a Sophie's choice, and she made the perfectly rational right decision, which was to bolt out of there. And you hear blood-curdling screams as they try accost her and try to grab her, and she escaped. And then when she escaped from them, she made the perfectly rational decision to knock on doors until she found somebody that would let her in.
Are the voices of anyone else heard in the background? Are men, can we tell that people are pursuing her? Do we hear the voices of other people on that tape?
You can hear, within several days from now, perhaps weeks, I've organized a presentation of what's on those tapes and other pieces of evidence that the police have ignored regarding Shannon Gilbert. I'm going to reveal them. They need to be revealed by enhancing the tape so you can listen to what's really on the voice enhancement of the tape, so you know what's really there. Something, by the way, the police department never did. They never enhanced the voices. They never did a transcript of the 9/11 tape. Who ever heard of that in a homicide investigation? And they didn't do it. I can prove that to you. They told me so.
And why hasn't it been? I mean, you've heard it, but it's never been released publicly, right?
The tape has now been released publicly. Rodney Harrison, when he came in, we met. He came to my office. We talked, and he, over the complete shock of the police that were with him, he said, "I'm going to release the tapes." So once he released them, I had the tapes. I had fought in the court for 2 years to get them. And I had won in court and then on the appeal. I had the tapes, but I wasn't allowed to use them. So now Rodney allowed, by publishing the tapes himself, he allowed me to use them. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm taking Brewer's testimony very shortly. I haven't given up. I've worked on this assiduously.
Where is he, Brewer? And, what does he do now?
He doesn't live in Oak Beach anymore. He lives back in his home, I think, where he had lived before on the mainland in the Islip area. And I'm not sure what he does for a living anymore. If he ever did anything of any substance, it's an open question. But he's well-to-do. He's not poor.
And Mike Pack, the driver, where is he now?
Yeah, Pack, I just took his testimony again using the tape of the 911 tape, and I took his testimony out in the state Supreme Court recently. So he's around, still lives in Flushing, and he was a sex trafficker, and he got busted for that, in bringing people from Thailand, and then he got a hold of Shannon. So he's still around, and I've taken his testimony. So we'll see how that all goes shortly, but. There's a real question about whether or not this Shannon's presence that night was a result of an organized operation rather than just an individual call between Brewer and her over Backpage, that evening. That was the spin. That doesn't sound like it's true anymore, based on what we now have. So there's a lot more to this case, incredibly more. And there's incredibly more facts and evidence that we've garnered about the case that the police either refuse to look at or don't have. Now that, with Rodney's leadership, they've taken some of the material we have about a year ago, and now we've developed more, and we're going to work with them, hopefully.
Well, we thank him very much, and best of luck as this thing continues. We're going to know more about how this all unfolded and came to fruition. Wow, just a horror show. And I will say this, the victims and their families, and this guy was apparently calling the family of a person he killed, taunting them, saying, "Yeah, I killed her," and just saying awful, awful things, and doing it repeatedly over a period of months. I mean, just the evil, the depravity, the inhumanity. It's those four folks, those poor folks, and what they went through. And so there's that. And I will tell you this, I do feel for the family of the accused. I'm sure the wife didn't know anything about this, the daughter, the stepson, and brothers and parents, and just it's a nightmare. It is an absolute nightmare. And it's one thing, look, when you're a victim, there's a great deal of sympathy, but when you are associated with the accused, maybe not so much, but maybe there should be. I don't know. It's just all awful, but also fascinating, right? True crime. It is. What is it about it? That why is it the most popular genre in just about any media? Huh? Why is that? I don't know. But I'm as fascinated as the next person, probably more so. Hey, once again, we thank D'Espresso Liber, the great coffee maker, right from a Green Beret, an amazing American hero. And they support quality farmers. They support America's Special Operations Community. Let's support them and get some great coffee while we're at it, okay? D'EspressoLiber.com. That's where you go to make your order. D'EspressoLiber.com. I'm going to spell the whole thing now, okay? D'EspressoLiber.com. 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 Liber. That's the tricky one, but that's how you say it. It's kind of a Latin thing. Hey, many thanks. To be continued, and we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.